This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In their race across the Gulf of Mexico, hurricanes Katrina and Rita slammed into offshore oil rigs, threatened underwater pipelines, and forced refineries to shut down. Americans who'd paid more than $3 a gallon for gasoline. Well, we're used to high gas prices. After all, energy prices have tripled over the past 2 years. But many were shocked by the recent earnings reports of major oil companies showing billion-dollar quarterly gains across the board. ExxonMobil, for example, earned nearly $10 billion in profit over the past 3 months. Now, Congress is investigating. Yesterday, the Senate grilled executives from the nation's five largest oil companies about everything from price gouging to future exploration to alternative energy. Proposals included a federal anti-gouging law, a tax on windfall profits, are some mechanism for oil companies to provide money or fuel to heat the homes of the poor this winter. Later this hour, an update from Amman, where three suicide bombers killed more than 50 people yesterday, and we'll find out why Rafael Palmero will not be charged with perjury. But first, oil profits. Should businesses, including yours, be exposed to windfall profits taxes? At what point do profits become unconscionable or illegal? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And we begin with Henry McMaster, Attorney General for the state of South Carolina, who's investigating actions of oil companies following the recent hurricanes. He joins us by phone from his office in Columbia, South Carolina. Nice to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Thanks, sir. Glad to be here.
How does you, or perhaps more to the point, the state of South Carolina, how do you define price gouging?
Well, we have a law that was passed about 2 years ago, 3 years ago, that defines it as an unconscionable rise in prices based on the last 30 days.
And
it's a fairly specific time period there, but the word unconscionable is not clearly defined and is left up to the discretion of the prosecutor.
And in this case, how are you choosing to define it?
Well, it's one of those things that we'll know it when we see it. I think because of the definition, because of the circumstances, you need to have a flexible definition. And we are now looking at prices. We've, out of all the complaints that we got over the period after Katrina and some after Rita, we got about 1,550 complaints. Some came directly to this office. Others were referred to us by the Department of Energy. And we went out and spoke to those people and talked to the people who complained and tried to get as much evidence we could. We boiled it down to about 13 places that we actually went to and looked through records, and now we have it boiled down out of that to 7 who at one point had their prices up at $4.79 and in that range. We got complaints of prices higher than that, but by the time we got there, or by the time we tried to confirm it, that high price was gone.
And so you're looking at gas stations as opposed to looking at ExxonMobil as a company, just to
yes,
pick one.
Well, we are, but we also, I mean, our statute, we have two statutes. One is a civil statute, an Unfair Trade Practice Act. It's all civil. It would apply to any unfair, deceptive trade practice.
Mm-hmm.
We have a specific price gouging statute that was passed after 9/11. Is the one I referred to a minute ago that has a criminal section, and the other part of it is civil. The criminal doesn't come in until the governor declares a state of emergency, which our governor did not do here in South Carolina. We're trying to get some changes in that would allow us to use it in circumstances where there are emergencies or states of emergency or declarations of disaster in other states that directly impact us. But we did meet with representatives of the big oil companies, BP, Shell, ConocoPhillips, and Marathon. We met with jobbers. We met with a lot of associations and got a lot of information. And the oil companies were very cooperative. And, of course, none of them could tell us. This was all before the big profits came out for, mm-hmm. for the third quarter. But they were all very frank that they were expecting some profits because that's what they were in the business to make. And, of course, we understand that. That's a free enterprise and the laws of supply and demand. And fortunately, we've got an economist on the staff here that's been able to lead us through some of this. But from what we've seen no evidence of anything that would constitute price gouging by the big oil companies. And our focus right now is the retailers. Now, we are planning to ask for additional information from the big oil companies in the wake of these high profits that have been declared. But the more you get into this area and trying to determine whether somebody is unreasonably raising their prices to take advantage on someone else, it gets to be a very, very sticky sort of thing to analyze because of the laws of supply and demand. Clearly, demand was up, supply was down because you had all those refineries out, the pipeline shut down, at least the two, the plantation and the Carolina pipeline that come up the East Coast, both of them were down for days.
Yeah.
And so you would expect prices to go up, and they did.
Mm-hmm. Has there been a history of successful prosecutions in South Carolina on this anti-gouging law?
No, because there's no history at all, because it was only put into effect a couple of years ago. It just passed. The only other time, so we've had no opportunity to use it.
Mm-hmm.
The Unfair Trade Practice Act is a little different. We have used that several times, not for price gouging, but for other things that were unfair or deceptive. We've used it here in this office. For example, we had a power company that was, when it was sending its bill out, it was adding an assessment for people who live within the city and been paying that assessment over to the city for the use of the city rights of way and facilities. Well, it turned out people living outside of the city limits were paying that assessment as well. So that was a We established a pattern there that they were doing it widely, and we brought a suit against them, and they paid all the people back and other power companies. It turned out had been doing the same thing. They say that it was all accidental, and it may have been, but they agreed to pay them back too. So we've used the Unfair Trade Practice Act a number of times, and it also has a private cause of action where any citizen can bring a lawsuit. When the government brings the lawsuit, it's a $5,000 per incident fine, and the money goes to the government. And that's what we were dealing with when we brought a case against the power company. If a private individual brings a case, and anybody is free to do that in this state if they think that the prices were gouged on them, if the Unfair Trade Practice Act is applicable to that, they'd have to make the case in court, but they can get treble damages and attorney's fees. Now, that has not been used in a price gouging situation, but it's been used in a variety of other situations successfully.
Attorney General McMaster, thanks very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you, sir.
Henry McMaster, a Republican, is Attorney General for the state of South Carolina. He joined us today from his office in Columbia, South Carolina. John Fialca is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal. He covers energy and the environment. He joins us here in Studio 3A. Nice to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Glad to be here.
And Attorney General McMaster was saying, you know, it's a sticky matter to investigate these anti-gouging allegations. And you did a story yesterday that showed it's a sticky matter almost everywhere in the country.
Well, what Attorney General McMaster is facing is fairly typical. There are 29 states with a variety of price gouging laws on their books. I've talked to attorneys general from five of them, and they all more or less say what he did, that they're making less than one case per 100 complaints because a lot of what they find are normal market activities. It's a moving train, and so they've had a great deal of difficulty with the laws that they have on their books.
Mm-hmm. There were proposals yesterday at the Senate hearing for a federal anti-gouging law. Right now there isn't one on the books, as far as I understand.
No, the federal law is our antitrust laws and the Federal Trade Commission regulations, and they require proof of a conspiracy or collusion in price fixing. In a lot of these cases that I looked at, you have station owners who are trying to figure out what the price is going to go to so that when they buy their next truckload of oil, they can pay for it. And so they're raising their prices, and they're being bombarded by, among other things, radio talk shows. Some of them had rumors of pipelines being destroyed. And so they're making a bet. And some of them, according to the attorneys general, were also gouging a bit, and we saw prices as high as $8.99 for premium. But for the investigator to come in and say at any given point in time, were you gouging or were you just trying to make enough to stay alive is a very hard thing to do.
That one case where you said $8.99 for premium, that was a case where they had lower prices set for regular and mid-range fuels, and then you got to the pump and found that there was only premium for sale.
That's right. You could see on the signs over the station the regular was at least a dollar and a half lower. When you got to the station, they put plastic bags over everything but premium, and so you were soaked.
Let's get callers on the line. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, totn@npr.org, and we'll begin with Sean. Sean calling us from Las Vegas.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I don't really have a problem with the oil companies making record profits because we live in a supply and demand capitalistic economy. What I do have a problem with is the Republicans in Congress who have the audacity to tell us that we need to cut social programs like food stamps and health care and education so we can give them back money for reinvestment. If they're making multi-billion dollar profits and those profits are going up by, you know, benchmarks of $1 billion, why do we need to give them more tax breaks, you know, when we've got people who are hungry, who don't have housing, who don't have access to education? It just seems silly to me, but I'll take my comments off the air.
Okay, Sean. Thanks very much for the call. And John Fialco, I think he's talking about the measures that were in the recent energy bill.
Well, yes, and there's one shoe that hasn't dropped, which is that the programs to assist the poor in paying their home heating bills this winter are about $3 billion short of what we think it will now take because fuel prices are between 40 and 70% higher. And gasoline has gone down, but diesel oil, heating oil, and natural gas are at nearly record levels. So that's the problem that the Republicans now have to face. They're in charge. What are they going to do about that? And what will they look like if we see people having to leave their homes because they can't afford to heat them?
John Fialca of the Wall Street Journal, stay with us. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call at 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. When we come back, we're going to be talking with one of those Republicans who's in charge of the United States Senate. That's Charles Grassley, senator from Iowa, chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, and find out what he proposes to do about this problem. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking today about the oil industry and its record profits of late. At yesterday's Senate hearing, Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon asked ExxonMobil chief Lee Raymond about a new congressional energy bill passed this past summer that encourages exploration of domestic oil and natural gas.
Why shouldn't Congress take back the billions of dollars in brand new tax breaks, breaks that you just told me aren't needed, and use that money to help people that are hurting in our country? Question. Mr. Raymond, your response?
I've heard that comment made many times since the passage of that legislation, and I've asked my people many times if they could identify what so-called tax breaks are in that legislation that would apply to ExxonMobil. And the answer they come back with is, when you add it all up, that energy legislation is zero in terms of how it affects ExxonMobil. Now, how it affects the industry, some other people can respond to.
So you would have no problem, because I'm on the Finance Committee and I'm going to offer an amendment, take back the $2.6 billion of brand new tax breaks and use that money to help people who are hurting. You said you're not getting any.
As far as my company is concerned, doesn't make any difference.
Good.
Whether it's there or not.
I'm glad you'll support me on Thursday, sir.
That's a different question.
Sir?
That's a different question.
Joining us now is Charles Grassley, Republican senator from Iowa, chairman of the Senate Finance Committee. He comes to us from his office on Capitol Hill. Senator Grassley, always nice of you to join us on the program.
Oh, I enjoy being on NPR.
Wondered, in response to that exchange that we were just listening to from yesterday, what about that? The industry gets a new package of tax breaks in the energy bill this past summer. Is this a moment to roll them back?
I think I would reflect upon the purpose of that probably being exactly the same as most tax breaks for the oil industry, at least within the 30 years I've been in the Congress. It's always been felt by people that propose these tax breaks that they were never for big oil. They were always for the independent producer because, quite frankly, big oil aren't the ones that go out and find the new areas to explore.
Mm-hmm.
It's the wildcatters in America, the independent oil producers that actually find the hard-to-get oil. And so these tax credits will be used by independent oil producers. They could be used by big oil, but you heard that they're not going to be used by big oil. And they're going to be used by the independent producer and get more of our own domestic production online. But that's not just because of this energy bill. That's been the traditional use of some of the credits that have been available for the oil industry. And, in fact, they have worked an awful lot.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've proposed that oil companies should donate 10% of their profits to help low-income families pay for home heating bills this winter, precisely the problem John Fiocca was talking about just before the break. How would that program work?
Well, it would work like any charitable giving, only in this particular case I would want it given to the federal government to be put in with a LIHEAP program because we already have the administrative structure set up to dispense federal dollars to low-income people. It's set up at the local level through the community action mm-hmm. programs that are also federally financed. And so it'd be the quickest way getting it there. The alternative is, you know, the idea of an excess profits tax. By the time we got an excess profits tax through Congress, hell would have frozen over and we would have had spring and not need the money.
Now, certainly, certainly Des Moines.
Yes. And so, consequently, this is within the spirit of corporate giving already, because most of these corporations already have some charitable giving.
Mm-hmm.
This is reflecting a very unique situation where gasoline and everything went up so high because of a natural disaster, and I wouldn't expect that to be repeated. So I wouldn't expect to have an excess profits tax well into the future. And this is something that is based upon just third quarter earnings, which are phenomenal. We got two oil companies that have together $50 billion in cash. So the resources are there. The dispensing agency to help the poor are there. And it can be done very, very quickly.
Senator Grassley, you mentioned it would be in the nature of charitable giving. Charitable giving is generally voluntary. Would you strongly urge the oil companies to donate 10% of their profits to this program?
I think my letter was very, very clear that not only did I strongly encourage it, I was suggesting that this was a social responsibility of corporations and that it ought to be done.
Were you satisfied? I know you're not a member of the committees who were listening to the oil executives yesterday, but I wondered if you were satisfied with their responses from what you heard.
Well, I'm not satisfied from the standpoint that I know for sure what they're going to do with their profits. Now, I've got nothing wrong with profits because all companies pay profits. They pay 35% tax. We got more money coming into the federal treasury now than we have for a long time from corporate profits. So it's a good thing for business. It's a good thing for jobs. It's a good thing for the federal treasury. But what about the money that they don't pay in taxes? They were not specific enough in the amount that was going to go for exploration, refining capacity, mm-hmm. and things of that nature. All they talked about was a large sum of money, and I don't dispute that, it's going to take to correct the damage done by Katrina.
Mm-hmm. Let's get some callers on the line again. This is Tim. Tim calling us from Severn, Maryland.
Yes. I would like to hear some comments on connections between the congressional investigation into the profits of oil companies with the pandemic plan that's been proposed. I see that, from my standpoint, the way Congress handled the situation with the oil companies could very easily set a precedent for something similar that could happen in the case of a pandemic, which would result in profit increases for pharmaceutical companies. And I'll take any reactions off the air.
All right, Tim, thanks very much for the call. Senator Grassley?
Well, I think to some extent we already have some of this, actually instituted, some of it by government through the rebate program, and some of it from pharmaceutical companies themselves setting up through discount cards, rebates or discounts for low-income people, and in some cases even giving the pharmaceutical entirely free. So I think that we are having some of that done now. And since money's fungible, it doesn't make much difference whether it comes from the oil companies or whether it comes from the pharmaceutical companies or even the income tax.
Mm-hmm.
Money that the pharmaceutical companies use, whether it's for a pandemic or whether it's for just low-income people, is still something put in place.
I think the questioner's call, though, was more about the idea of unique situations allowing companies to make unique profits, as in post-Katrina with the oil companies, and maybe he's suggesting in the midst of a flu pandemic, maybe the drug companies will be making record profits as well. Whether they will or not, of course, remains to be seen.
Yeah, I apologize for not getting that nuance. But
yeah.
I guess my best answer is let's wait and see what happens.
Yeah.
The other thing is, though, we're kind of in a situation in America where because of lawsuits, we're not having these companies make these vaccines. So quite frankly, we have to use the federal treasury as an incentive for the production of this. And we're going to set the price and we're going to stockpile it. And that's the incentive for getting some people to produce it.
John Fialka, I just wanted to bring you into the conversation and ask you, what is the response of the oil companies to the suggestion from Senator Grassley, and he's not the only one, to saying that they should return a percentage of their profits to help heat the homes of the poor this winter?
Well, they have a variety of responses. The first one being is they sustain somewhere between $18 billion and $30 billion worth of damage during the storm, and nobody's helping them with that, and they don't expect it. The other is they're in a cyclical business, and this is a very high up, but they've also had some very high downs, low downs, in the past 2 decades. And so to expect them to share their profits in a good year ignores the bad years. What do you do about that? Plus, they do give generously in local areas where they are, so that's kind of where they are on this. I don't expect them to suddenly reach into their pockets and donate 10% of their profits.
Let's get another caller on the line. This is Philip. Philip from Palo Alto.
Hi. I just had a question about refining capacity. It's been kind of perplexing looking at how refineries haven't been built. Some have said for the last 20 years, and some of the older refineries have been taken offline. I thought that I've heard some antitrust implications about that. And I'm just wondering, with all of this, these windfall profits that are in place, I guess they'll have to offset it by rebuilding some of the damaged refineries that were damaged during Katrina.
Mm-hmm.
But what's going on there? And when the supply is constrained by not having more refineries online, what are they going to do about that with all this extra money?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Philip. Senator Grassley, we found out after the hurricanes how very close to the edge we were on refining capacity.
Yeah, well, we haven't had refineries built in the United States in the last 30 years. We've gone down from about a 270 down to about 160, so it's a very much of a bottleneck, even more so than new sources of energy. So I think the rationale behind it is long licensing period with all sorts of opportunities for government regulators or environmentalists or people that don't want a refinery in their backyard to step in and stall it. And so companies that that have capital that they just relish putting into new refineries right now don't want to look ahead 10 years to go through all the red tape that they're going through, so we just haven't had any built. Now, we have the House of Representatives passing a piece of legislation that would make it easier to what you would do is have the federal government kind of preempt a local siting like we did with the liquid natural gas
yeah.
in the energy bill last August. You would you would do the same thing for the siting of refineries and also put some refineries on federal property, because the presumption is the federal government ought to be able to build anything they want to on property that they own.
Mm-hmm.
And just short-circuit all of the red tape that stops it from being done, and we think it'll be done. Now, the House of Representatives has passed that, but it's blocked in the Senate committee on a 9-9 vote with some rationale, well, we ought to do something about the mileage, gas mileage that cars get, or we ought to do something about this or that. The point is, we probably ought to do all these things, including siting. But you don't ever get everything you want done, and we ought to do piecemeal, if we have to do it, to get the job done. And if we could do piecemeal the siting of new refineries, we ought to get the job done, because, you know, what makes our economy grow is energy. And Americans are used to going to the gas tank, and when they put that hose in their tank, and when I do it, I want to get gas out of it. And when I turn the light switch on, I want the lights to go on, and I don't want somebody to tell me I got to change my way of living to satisfy them, because this is America, and this is something we've worked our way into, and the American people are entitled to it. And if we're going to improve our standard of living, you have to consume more energy. Now, you don't have to consume more energy in an illogical way. Conservation can be a part of it, and that's why one-third of our energy bill was related to conservation.
We're speaking with Senator Charles Grassley of Iowa and with John Fialka of the Wall Street Journal about record gasoline prices and record oil company profits. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And John Fialka, let me ask you, there are some, as you know, who say the oil companies have an incentive to keep their margins very, very close, precisely for this kind of situation. When there's a crisis of some sort, there will be a shortage. They'll make a lot of money.
Well, they call that just-in-time delivery. And the problem is I don't think the oil companies really wanted the situation they got after the hurricanes that drove gasoline prices up. And they really don't want the situation we face this winter with high heating oil, natural gas prices. Both parties would like to see some relief to this. But what you're seeing is a very high state of political football here between Republicans and the Democrats. This should be a Republican issue. It happened on their watch. They have made energy policy a big campaign item, and these are their supporters. Oil companies give 85% of their donations to Republicans. And now for them to appear to be powerless in this situation, not to be able to affect either supply or demand, is an embarrassment they're all trying in various ways to dodge. And the Democrats, by holding straight party line votes in the House, are trying to make them guilty of it.
Yeah, keep their feet to the fire.
Absolutely.
Well, now, is the suggestion that the government can affect supply, that we can somehow pull a magic lever here since Katrina and help this out? You're talking about decisions we make today having an impact, hopefully beneficial, 2 or 3 years down the road, or in the case of ethanol, fully implemented in the year 2012.
Well, Senator, you're seeing two decisions before you involving drilling in the Arctic for oil and opening up offshore areas and federal land for oil that could increase the supply.
And not getting the job done. Yeah.
Well, it's stuck because of this partisan issue that I was talking about.
I understand. And I'm embarrassed. I'm embarrassed for all members of Congress, because it's so obvious we have an oil shortage, and some of these things can help that. The very same people complaining, though, that we've got this problem are some of the same ones that are voting against drilling offshore and drilling in Alaska. And it seems to me to be intellectually dishonest positions to take.
And John Fialka, Democrats, they're not in power, but that is a problem that they should have to address, too.
Well, and then there's the second problem, which is one way to cure the demand side of the problem quickly is to tighten the federal controls on automobile efficiency, which the polls say the public would support. But again, you have a very powerful interest group, the automakers here, that don't want it. And so the Congress finds itself stymied.
And also two Michigan senators that feel that doing that would create more unemployment in their Democratic state.
Senator Grassley, you've made a good point. Thank you very much for being with us today. I'm afraid we're running out of time. We have to let you go. But thanks very much for joining us. Charles Grassley, Republican from Iowa, chairman of the Senate Finance Committee. He joined us from a studio on Capitol Hill. We're talking today about how the oil industry makes its money. Coming up next, a representative from the oil industry joins us to take your questions. Also, we'll get an update on what Congress had to say about baseball star Rafael Palmeiro, steroids, and possible charges of perjury. I'm Neil Conan. Back after the break, it's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Right now, we're focusing on the oil industry. Last week, America's oil companies reported record profits. Earlier this week, company executives defended their good news to a Senate committee. At issue were concerns about price gouging and unfair advantages. Joining us now to give us an industry point of view is Denise McCourt. She's director at the American Petroleum Institute. She joined us here in Studio 3A, where our other guest, John Fialco of the Wall Street Journal, also is. And Denise McCourt, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Nice to be here.
How do oil companies make their money? Is it an anomaly that those third quarter earnings reports were so high?
Oil companies make their money by going out and looking for oil around the world, by refining it and by delivering it to customers every single day, 24/7.
And is it an anomaly for those profits in the third quarter?
The profits in the third quarter, if you actually look at them, are based on maybe cents per dollar of sales. Were 8 cents per dollar of sales. That's pretty average when you look at industry overall. The challenge for us, of course, is the oil industry is very, very large, and so the revenues sound very, very large. These are global companies. Consequently, when you hear the numbers, they sound big. When you look at it the way economists look at it, the way Business Week, for example, looks at its statistics, overall, we've been pretty average. We did earn some more money in the third quarter of 2005 than we have in past quarters. We've been at the 7.1 cents, 5.5 cents, but it's still small numbers per dollar of sales. Lee Raymond at ExxonMobil yesterday, when he testified, mentioned that fact, that people think that they're earning a dollar for every gallon that they sell, and that's simply not the case. So it was a good opportunity yesterday for some of the companies to have a chance to explain exactly what those earnings mean.
Mm-hmm. The price of gasoline came down rather precipitously, just as it went up rather precipitously, too. Are there reasons for this? Is the supply eased up?
Absolutely. Several things happened after the two hurricanes, which really did tremendous damage to our industry overall. Most importantly, the lack of power in the Gulf Coast meant that we couldn't get our tankers in, that we couldn't get our refineries going, that we couldn't get the product of the pipeline. And so consequently, right after the hurricanes, we saw real concerns out there about whether or not the supply was going to come back on board. And of course, it's only natural for us in the industry to say, you should see what our companies did, what our employees that our companies did to bring all this product back online. In addition to pulling our refinery capacity back online, and we still have about 8% down, we also imported a tremendous amount of gasoline. We can import gasoline from Western Europe. That's been brought over, and that has helped tremendously. That's why you saw, while the prices spiked above $3 a gallon, they've come back down now. A little bit more of a challenge with diesel fuel, to be honest. The guys in Western Europe really like diesel fuel, so there wasn't much out there to get. So what we saw happen was diesel fuels had hung up higher longer than the gasoline. We've seen them come back down, but not as much as people might want.
And I have to ask, obviously there were heroic efforts to get supplies up and running again. Yet there were a lot of questions yesterday talking about how the industry responds to the plight of the poor consumer, people who are making choices between filling up their car so they can go back to work and back and forth to work, or buying drugs and food. People are strapped, and it seemed to them that in a time of extremity that they were being asked to pay these extraordinarily high prices for gasoline, which they turn around and suddenly see are represented in extraordinarily high profits.
You know, the big challenge out here is talking about gasoline, because it is a commodity. It is traded on the New York Mercantile Exchange. This is this group think of thousands of traders every single day saying, what is the expectation globally for supply and demand? First of all, even before the hurricanes, we were seeing tremendous global demand, particularly from China and India. Then after the hurricanes, you saw the price of crude oil being traded at almost $70 a barrel. It's come back down now a little bit below 60. crude oil is the most important determinant in the price of gasoline you pay at the pump.
Mm-hmm.
That said, globally, as the CEOs testified yesterday, crude oil, the price of crude oil is reflected in the price of gasoline. If you look at it over time, crude oil prices go up, gasoline prices go up. Crude oil goes down, gasoline prices go down. And that's exactly what we saw happen and we see happening since the hurricanes.
Mm-hmm. Let's get a caller on the line, and this is Barry. Barry's calling us from Alaska.
Yeah, hi. I was wondering if somebody could speak to the breakdown of profits from just crude oil sales versus refined product sales, because it seems like refiners shouldn't have such a huge margin when their raw material prices are going up. They have any comment on that?
Well, Denise McCourt?
You know, Barry, I'm not an economist, but I can tell you that the reality is that sometimes different segments of the industry make different earnings at different times. In fact, sometimes the upstream segment does extremely well, and sometimes the downstream segment does extremely well, and sometimes neither one of them does extremely well. When we had $10 a barrel oil, nobody was doing well. In some instances, if you're an integrated oil company and you're taking the product out of the ground and you're also refining it and you're also selling it, you may be doing well. And consequently, I think that's what you saw happen in this particular instance. But if you were a company that was having to buy, you were in that situation. And in fact, we saw that right down to the retail level, where you saw some companies that had long-term supply contracts for product, and they were able to price their product a certain way. And then you had companies that typically buy in the spot market and were caught shorthanded and either had no supply or their prices were much higher than some of the regular people. So all across the system, you see these differentials.
John Fiocca?
Well, one of the problems that doesn't come up in a discussion like this is natural gas, although that may be the most painful issue over time, given record high natural gas prices this winter. And also the fact that we pay the highest prices for natural gas now in the world, and the result is that our petrochemical industry is leaving us, taking thousands upon thousands of high-paying jobs. In the spring, farmers start up their tractors to plow the fields, and they'll be paying record high prices for diesel unless something happens. So this is going to ricochet in our economy and echo politically for some time to come. It's not over yet.
And let me ask you before we let you go, John Fiocca, about your political assessment of the proposals you heard yesterday. Are we likely to see a windfall profits tax, a federal anti-gouging tax? And what about you said the oil company's response to Senator Grassley's suggestion about donations to home heating oil projects was less than enthusiastic.
What you're seeing is a lot of political nostrums here, the ideas that haven't worked very well on the state level or in our experience of windfall profits in the past. What you're not seeing is movement either on the supply side, finding more supplies in the United States and letting oil companies get at them, or measures on the demand side to curb our appetite for gasoline. If you could somehow improve the efficiency of the transportation sector, you could make a big dent in that problem. But I don't think either one is going to happen in this Congress.
John Fiocca, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
John Fiocca is a reporter for the Wall Street Journal who covers energy and the environment. And we'd also like to thank Denise McCourt for taking the time to join us here in Studio 3A. She's a director at the American Petroleum Institute. Thanks for being with us. And when we come back, an update from Amman Jordan on the situation a day after the hotel bombings.